Thank you for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly hour-long news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Ryan Patrick Jones.
I'm Alex DeBoer.
And I'm Arika Riaz. It's Thursday, February 1st at 5.02 p.m. We're broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Today's show features original reporting from City Hall. First Democracy Watch airs a story on Monday's empty house tax announcement. We will then turn to a piece on local vigils honoring the mass murder of Muslim worshippers in Quebec 1 year ago. After that, Democracy Watch presents a report on the Northeast False Creek plan put before City Council yesterday. This plan involves the development of the False Creek and Strathcona area, currently covered by viaducts, and the reimagining of Vancouver's displaced Black community in Hogan's Alley. But first, headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland.
The governments of British Columbia and Alberta are engaged in a small-scale trade war after BC Premier John Horgan announced his intention to pass new oil spill regulations. The proposed regulations call for a temporary ban on increases to the amount of bitumen shipped into Alberta to BC's coasts until the effects of oil spills can be studied and better understood. These regulations, if kept in place, would effectively block the Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain pipeline from being built. Today, Alberta Premier Rachel Notley responded by calling the move illegal and unconstitutional, threatening to sue BC government and ensue in a trade war. Today, Notley announced a suspension of talks with BC over the purchase of electricity from that province. BC currently receives about $500 million revenue each year from electricity purchases. Hogan played down the impact of the proposal, saying no new regulations are in place yet and that a public consultation is underway.
So also in the news today, there was a police incident on Mount Seymour, and it closed a popular trail. Two men have been taken into hospital. So we've heard that it's a possible stabbing on Mount Seymour Thursday morning that closed off the Dog Mountain Trail. Armed police officers were seen heading up the trail, and the mountain is now open to the public. It was closed off for most of the day, but the trail is still being contained by police. The North Shore Rescue was also called in to assist at the scene. Team leader Mike Danks told the Global News that they were originally called in to assist with an injury, but then they changed that to a stabbing.
Vancouver City Council approved the rezoning application for an empty lot at 58 West Hastings. You may remember this headline from previous coverage Democracy Watch has done. So the rezoning application includes an integrated health center at the bottom and commercial real estate space. And then it includes 231 units of social housing, half of which will be rented at welfare and pension rates. Those rates are around $375 a month, close to a welfare check. So approval came after a public hearing was held 2 weeks ago where over 50 speakers attended to make their views heard. And the majority of those speakers were opposed to the plan as it stood, which was in large part because Mayor Gregor Robertson made a promise in 2016, a promise that he signed onto a piece of paper, which was a makeshift contract, that said 100% of the units would be rented at welfare and pension rates. So that promise was broken. City Councilor Melissa DeGovna seemed to call out the mayor and address this issue by adding a motion called Keeping Promises, approving and expediting one building of 100% core needed rental housing in the downtown east side. The motion noted that Robertson never took any official action to follow through on his pledge, and the city-owned residence would be dedicated to residents on income assistance.
Sorry, who was the councillor who passed that motion, Alex?
Melissa DeGenova.
All right, thank you.
I'm so sorry. Thank you for that correction.
No
Ryan,
problem.
Patrick Jones.
So in a recent motion to change local Crosstown Elementary School's name, the Vancouver School Board voted against this motion. They voted 5-3, and it was to rename the elementary school after a Chinese Canadian. This proposal was put forward by Trustee Alan Wong. Another trustee present at the vote, Janet Fraser, said she voted against the proposal because the motion did not come from students or parents, and there are currently no schools in Vancouver named after Chinese Canadians.
Yeah, that headline I think is pretty important. There's been a lot of conversations in the media recently. A couple of things I've listened to on the CBC about the symbolism of what we call buildings and streets and other important places in our society. And so I think this is an interesting debate to follow.
Yeah, so I'm interested in what the trustee Janet Fraser said in the. She basically said that she voted against the proposal because the motion didn't come from the community. So,
yes,
per se, she's not exactly opposed to the motion, like the substance of the motion. But so, if that proposal was coming from the community, would she vote for it? Is that what she's saying?
That's what I think is implied. That, or she's using that as an excuse to not pass something that she disapproves of in its content. So we don't really know, I guess.
All right. So, this week, the BC Coroner Service released the final statistics for 2017 relating to the number of overdose deaths in the province. 1,420 people died last year in British Columbia due to illicit drug overdoses. That's a 43% increase from 2016. And that number is actually expected to grow as well as more test results come in. And fentanyl was involved in 80% of the cases, often mixed in with other drugs such as heroin, cocaine, or methamphetamines. The chief coroner called it the most tragic year ever and said that if it weren't for fentanyl, we would not be seeing this many deaths. Some other interesting statistics to come from the report show that nearly 90% of people who died were alone inside a home when they suffered from an overdose. 4 out of 5 of the deaths were men, and more than half of all victims were between the age of 30 and 49. Tellingly, nobody died at a supervised injection site or an overdose prevention site. And I think that's one of the most important statistics to come from this report. What do you guys think?
Yeah, definitely. And this tragedy is just going on, and drug policy reform is moving slowly, and we just continue to see headlines like this throughout the year. And yeah, it's sad. So the former city planners are warning that passage of the Northeast False Creek plan could rob some Vancouver residents of their beloved mountain views. So in 1989, the city passed a policy to protect 11 view corridors that allowed them to see the North Shore Mountains for much of downtown Vancouver. A clause in the Northeast False Creek plan would allow future developments to be 42 stories high, partially blocking the view corridor from Cambie and 11. Brent Totterine, a Vancouver city planner from 2006 to 2012, said residents of Vancouver care about preserving the view corridors. So we're going to talk more about the Northeast Creek plan later in the broadcast. We have some original reporting from City Hall yesterday. So this is one of the important but less important parts of that plan.
All right. Next up, two cities in Metro Vancouver are planning to ban cannabis dispensaries. White Rock and Delta city councils both held public hearings this week on bylaw changes that would effectively ban marijuana pot shops within their city limits. The plans come even as the federal government is planning to legalize marijuana across the country on July 1st, although that legislation is still stuck in the Senate and hasn't been passed officially yet. The mayor of White Rock, Wayne Baldwin, pointed out that cities in BC do not allow dispensaries, or sorry, the cities in BC that do allow dispensaries tend to have their own police force. So, for example, Vancouver, it's got its own police force. It tends to allow dispensaries as well, whereas White Rock is policed by the RCMP, who enforce federal laws. On top of that, Burnaby, Richmond, and Surrey all don't allow marijuana dispensaries to operate as well, and they all say that they're waiting for the provincial regulations to kick in, and we'll see. Yeah, because I guess it really depends on what the province, you know, the regulatory framework that the province sets up in expectation of the July 1st legalization before they can really make any sound policies regarding marijuana dispensaries.
Right. It's a bit confusing how it's different in different cities, but
absolutely.
Yeah, more to come on that. So Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM will return after a short break, so please stay tuned.
The new Emily Carr University campus is hosting its first exhibition of 2018 on January 25th from 6 to 9 p.m. called Leaning Out of Windows, Step 1. The exhibition combines artworks made through artist-scientist collaborations and will include a panel discussion called The Translation Hub on January 27th from 2 to 5. The exhibition is up from January 26th to February 8th.
Go to a party with me?
No, the game's on.
Oh, I almost forgot. I'll be right there.
We like sports and we don't care who knows. From shooting hoops to the Super Bowl.
Do you like sports and don't care who knows? Then CITR Sports needs you. If you like sports, are into radio, or generally just want to have a great time, then come join us. Email our sports coordinator at sports101@citr.ca to find out more, or come by the station in the new sub. See you soon.
Watch, cause I'm the man.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Strength,
dignity,
respect,
beauty,
self-worth,
safety,
confidence,
choice,
hope.
The Beauty Night Society is a registered charity dedicated to helping marginalized women introduce trust, hope, and self-esteem into their lives.
This is the first day of
Through its popular makeover program, the Beauty Night Society has touched the lives of thousands and reintroduced a healthy touch to the lives of vulnerable women throughout British Columbia, creating real life makeovers.
Please visit www.beautynight.org for information on programs and on how to help. Beauty Night, because dignity is beautiful.
We're back. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We just heard headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. We'll be now turning to a short report by News Collective comrade Zoe Powers. Zoe went to City Hall this Monday to hear about an announcement about Vancouver's empty houses tax. As of Monday, 89% of all residential property owners have submitted declarations to the city. Properties deemed vacant will be subject to an empty homes tax at a rate of 1% of the property's 2017 assessed taxable value. Let's listen to Zoe's report to hear more.
Tomorrow, February 2nd, is the final day for homeowners here in Vancouver to declare the residential status of their properties before the city's new empty homes tax kicks in later in the year. Here's Mayor Gregor Robertson speaking about that deadline earlier in the week.
You've had a rental housing crisis in Vancouver for a number of years now. This is an important tool to address our lack of rental housing. We're hoping to see lots of what were empty homes become part of the long-term rental supply. There are approximately 25,000 empty or underused homes in Vancouver, according to the last Canada census. And that's obviously unacceptable. When we have great job growth, population growth, we need to see our homes used as residences and not as investment properties or commodities. So we're the first city in Canada.
Vancouver is the first city in Canada to implement anything like this tax. And what it means is any property which is unoccupied for 6 months of the year or more will face a tax at 1% of the assessed value of that property, as well as another $250 fine if people fail to declare before the Friday deadline. On Monday, Mayor Robertson sounded really happy with the fact that 89% of homeowners in the city had already responded to this survey. But he did also face some really tough questions from the crowd, particularly about how this tax is going to actually be implemented and audited once it's in place.
To be fair, 11% is a pretty good compliance rate. The bigger question is how many of the people who've responded are lying.
That's the voice of Michael Geller, a prominent planning critic here in Vancouver.
Some people are going to pay the tax because it's not that significant, but the majority of people who have the empty homes right now are looking at creative legal ways to get around it, whether it's signing leases with relatives, and they will argue that, yes, there was a lease in place, and I didn't know that person wasn't occupying the unit. So if they enter into a lease with someone who doesn't occupy the unit, do the lawyers go after the homeowner, or do they go after the person who had the lease? I mean, in London, what happened is people brought in tables and chairs before the inspector came around, and they called it the tables and chair tax. I think the city knows it's going to be extremely difficult, and the kind of people who are lying are the kind of people who traditionally lie about taxes that they owe.
The city was understandably pretty tight-lipped about the audit process itself, but did also make a point of emphasizing that the goal of this tax is not necessarily to actually generate as much income as possible.
I mean, it's probably best that we not release a lot of information about the audit, not that we aren't really excited about what we're doing here, but it can impact the integrity of the audit if people use that to try and determine if there's a way to avoid an audit. Because it is really important for everyone who's declared honestly to know that there is a good audit process behind it to make sure that everyone's declaring properly. This is the first year of the tax, and so we really don't have a target, and we're not 100% sure what the revenue would be. The goal, of course, is to create rental properties, so we're not hoping to collect the tax just for the sake of the tax. We'd like to increase the number of rental properties that are available. So success may be lower revenue in the long term, so we'll see at the end of this year, and we'll be reporting back in the fall on the full results.
That's Patrice Impe, the Chief Financial Officer and General Manager for this project. Because the tax is the first of its kind to be implemented anywhere in the country, there remain a lot of fundamental unknowns about what kind of effect it's going to have on Vancouver's already strained housing market. So here's a final thought from Michael Geller on Monday morning.
So I think the biggest question is, will this work in terms of increasing the stock of affordable or even relatively affordable rental housing? And that's what remains to be seen. But I will bet my house we will not see 25,000 vacant 20 units brought onto the rental housing market.
That was a report assembled by Zoe Powers. I am Rahmatullah Sheikh, and this is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you for continuing to listen. We will now be turning to a somber story about the remembering of Canada's second largest mass shooting. This is how every prayer begins in mosques all over the world. But for 6 men attending the evening prayers at a mosque in Quebec, this was to be the last recitation they hear. On January 29, 2017, a gunman opened fire on worshippers at the Quebec Islamic Cultural Center, also known as the Grand Mosque. 6 men died, and 19 others were wounded. Now, it's easy for victims to become mere numbers, faceless individuals devoid of both life and an identity worth remembering. And neglect is easier when the victims are foreign to Canada's collective understanding of culture, ethnicity, and even faith. But at Democracy Watch, we will read out their names. Mahmoudou Tanu Barry, Ezzedine Soufiane, Abdul Karim Hassan, Ibrahim Barry, Abu Bakr Sabti, Khalid Belkasmi, these all lost their lives that evening. Vigils were held in commemoration of the victims and survivors across Canada. There were 2 events organized in Vancouver. One of them was held at Al Masjid Al Jamia, Vancouver's oldest mosque. There we spoke to Kashif Ahmed, board chair of the National Council for Canadian Muslims, who explained the state of Islamophobia in British Columbia and Vancouver. But first, we asked him about the significance of this vigil.
Today's event was really about standing in solidarity with the families and the victims
of the horrific attack in Quebec City on January 29th, 2017. It was about community and coming together in reflection of what we can do to ensure that we remain in Vancouver, a place that is welcoming, inclusive, and that stands up against hate of any kind, including Islamophobia.
So you told us of a few statistics which paint a grim picture about attacks against religious minorities or minorities in general in BC, in Canada, in Vancouver. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, unfortunately, Stats Canada and other agencies are reporting a general increase in hate crimes, not just against the Muslim community, but against all communities. So there is a concern there about what's fueling this increase and what can we do about it. Unfortunately, for the Muslim community, the largest rise has been with respect to the Muslim community. And between 2012 and 2015, there was a 253% increase in police-reported hate crimes. In Vancouver, you know, we don't have direct data, but one of the issues we were talking about at the National Council of Canadian Muslims is encouraging police services across the country to publicly report the hate crime incidents that get reported to them, so that we as a community in Vancouver or in Calgary or elsewhere, wherever we are, have a better idea of what's actually happening in terms of hate crimes. Knowledge is power. So once we know what's happening, we can tackle it. Underreporting is a huge issue. So in Vancouver, we the Muslim community is in discussions with the RCMP, with Vancouver Police Department, as to how we can move this forward about better reporting regarding hate crimes, so we know what's actually happening on the ground.
So are those discussions going forward and forming into some concrete proposal, or are these still in discussions?
They're mostly in discussions. I think there's a willingness on the part of all police services to deal with this issue, but it's also a function of resources. Our police services need more resources to do their jobs effectively. And I think as this discussion goes forward with both with municipal, provincial, and federal governments, we'll see, God willing, some concrete results in the near future that will, in fact, benefit all communities, not just the Muslim community.
What is your sense of the Islamophobia scene in Vancouver?
So at the National Council of Canadian Muslims, we track hate crimes reported across the country. We have an online map at www.nccm.ca, which tracks in real time what's actually happening. And in Vancouver, we also have what's called the BC Islamophobia Legal Hotline, which is staffed by lawyers who take calls from members of the public. And both NCCM and the BC Hotline, I think, continue to see reports of hate incidents directed against the Muslim community. Unfortunately, Muslim women continue to be the largest target of hate incidents because they're often visible as Muslims, right? And that is a troubling trend that we need to deal with.
How is this affecting the Muslim community in Vancouver, then? How are they dealing with this?
Unfortunately, I think the community has still not come to full terms with what hate crimes mean. There's a lack of knowledge on the part of many of our members about what to do when a hate crime happens. Up to two-thirds of hate crimes go unreported to police. That's a huge problem. And NCCM started a campaign last year, actually 2 years ago, to encourage people to come up for and say, hey, I've been victimized and I want to report it to police and to NCCM. So there is still a sense of, I don't know what to do in our community, in the Muslim community in BC and elsewhere. It's not unique to BC, it's unique to the country, the Muslim community across the country. There is a lack of understanding as to how to deal with a hate crime. Many of our people come from backgrounds where they don't trust law enforcement or they don't understand law enforcement and they don't know what their rights are. So getting past that initial hurdle of underreporting is our biggest challenge.
Is there a city or a province that Vancouver can look up to as a model which is dealing with Islamophobic attacks rather efficiently?
I don't think there's a particular model yet, but there are a few steps being taken across the country that I think are positive. For example, in Ontario, the Ontario government has created an actual anti-racism directorate within the government, which is tasked with looking at issues about systemic racism, discrimination, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism. And they formed community consultative bodies that are in discussion with the government of Ontario as to how to move forward on a concrete anti-racism strategy for Ontario. I think that's something which we can replicate across the country. So there are these ideas and policy proposals that are coming forward that we should look at in BC and see is it possible to also implement here as a province.
There are a lot of kids here who are dancing around, playing around, rather innocent. How do you explain to them this horrific incident of the Quebec mosque attack?
That's a great question. And, you know, I have a 17-month-old son who eventually is going to be at an age where he's going to be able to ask these questions. What happened? It's a very tough question to answer. Kids are so innocent, and they only see the good in each other. They see goodness in all of us. It's very difficult to talk to kids about these issues, but I think we need to explain to kids that there is a challenge out there, and that not everyone will see you the way you see them, and that we need to work with like-minded people who love each other, who show solidarity, to prevent these kinds of acts from happening. I don't think we can hide these acts from our children, but we need to educate them about what the reality is and how we can work together as Canadians to overcome these horrific events.
If there is one message that you would want people to walk out from this mosque after this event, what would that be?
My one message would be that solidarity means more than anything to Canadians in times of need like this. And clearly in this time of need of the Muslim community, Canadians have come out in force, both back on the actual day of the event, January 29, 2017, and every month after. There has been such an outpouring of love and support. And that's the one thing I think we should all remember, that we are all in this together, and that Canadians will continue to be united against hatred.
That was Kashif Ahmed, board chair of the National Council for Canadian Muslims. Amongst the speakers at the vigil was Noor Fadhil. She was the victim of an Islamophobic assault on the SkyTrain last December, and she was one of the organizers of the vigil. What your recollections are of January 29th, 2017?
Oh, I just remember I was at home with my family, and I got off work, I believe, and I just remember just turning on the TV with my dad, and we just saw breaking news. And immediately when we saw it, we didn't know it was an attack at the mosque. We just know there was an attack. And I think at that moment, I thought it was like, please don't say it's a Muslim again, you know? And then when we realized it was against the masjid, we were just completely taken back. And I think at that moment, the next day, it was kind of like my family were more hard on us going out. My dad didn't like us going out at night. He installed these apps on our phone just to kind of give us an idea of where we are during the day in case anything happens and stuff. It was kind of like a wake-up call that, you know, they've been telling us since we were younger, be careful, but it was kind of like reality finally hit in.
So why do you think marking this as a day of remembrance and in honor of those victims, why is that important, and why do you think are so many organizations rallying for this day to be marked as the day of remembrance?
Because it was a loss that, you know, we as Muslims, we have been talking and we have been fighting for so long, talking about the rise of Islamophobia, talking about hate crimes in general. And every single time we've ever said something, the response back is, racism doesn't exist in Canada. And what happened at the Quebec, you know, what happened there that proved to us that it is happening. And what happened with myself that proves even more that is happening. And we need to have a day to remember those victims of such, you know, crime, and to take that as a day as well for us Muslims in general, for us to be able to speak up our voices and to have a platform and to show people that it does happen, and it doesn't just happen to us, it's happening to minorities, and we need to take it seriously. We need to take actual action towards it to prevent it from the future.
Right, so you were a victim of an alleged Islamophobic attack yourself,
yes.
And the acting mayor in the mosque read out a proclamation and affirmed his support for survivors and for anyone who may be a victim. Do you think that proclamation is enough? What more can Vancouver do?
It's a good start to have the proclamation. It's a good start, but it's just a piece of paper. And that's what I see it as. You know, if you want to bring real change and to kind of prevent things and to kind of show that it is real, you know, like I was discussing today, I was at a meeting and we were talking about having it in the education system, having something where we can educate people, because that's where it all comes from. It comes from the lack of knowledge you have on certain religions or certain people or just hate crimes in general. And so having that available and more advertisements on public transportation and in, you know, if someone plays soccer, for example, and in the feel just simply wearing a hijab, some girls are told they can't play because of it. To have that, you know, more kind of smaller steps, as in like advertisements on the trains or having that into our school system, can really go a big difference.
Since the December 4th attack, what has been the response of the communities in Vancouver about your Islamophobic incident? And does that in some way indicate how Vancouver community at large is dealing with Muslims and how they perceive Muslims in this city?
There was a lot of support. There was a lot of support in the beginning, and then it kind of died down a bit. I mean, there wasn't much. I feel like I was met up with all these politicians, and they were sitting with me over coffee or tea or something and talking about change, but then that was all it was. We went home, and life just continued to move on. And so that's why I've been really connecting with people now, and we are creating projects and getting into organizations and meeting up with other organizations to come up with ways to keep the conversation going to actually create change. And I've been getting in touch with the TransLink, some of the members from the TransLink board, and about what things that we can do on TransLink and like Canada Line, for example, and stuff like that, and as well as dealing with the voices of Muslim women. We are organizing some things as well, such as like this vigil today, and just starting small and hopefully getting up there even more.
There are many young Muslims in Vancouver who want to affirm to their Islamic faith and at the same time thrive in their Canadian identity. What is your message to people of your age?
Be yourself. You know who you are. Society is going to try to change you, and I know it can feel hard. If I'm going to be personal here, and I will, the night before the attack, I was speaking with my mom, and I told her, Mom, what would you do if I took my hijab off? That was the night before the incident happened. And I felt like that was because society was taking over, you know. I felt like I had boundaries around me because I wore the hijab. And then when the attack happened, I realized, and I got asked this question from, I think it was CTV, and they said, do you ever think of taking your hijab off? And I said, not anymore. And I realized it's my identity and it's who I am. And because of it, I am empowered. What happened to me wasn't something good, but it brought good out of it. I was able to twist it around and turn it into something bigger and to give myself a platform. And now I'm out there, and now I'm speaking, and now people look at me and they know who I am, and I inspire them, and I hope to continue to inspire them and to inspire youth to speak up as well. And that's what you need. You have to stay true to yourself and realize your life is a journey, and everything that happens to you happens for a reason. You just have to live by it and stick to well to yourself, and from that, believe me, good things will come.
Right. As usual, it's a pleasure to speaking to you.
Yes,
thank you so much.
For you. No worries. No worries at all.
Thank you.
No worries. Take care.
Thank you.
Unlike Noor, victims of the Quebec mosque attack were not lucky enough to live and tell their stories. At Monday's vigil, a cousin of Mohamedou Tano, one of those murdered, read out a moving letter from his wife.
Tano, he was my cousin. He came to Canada 8 years ago. He studied accounting and was working as accountant. He was the kind of person that you meet in the morning and by the end of the day you became friends with. The kind of person who leaves his cases and help you on yours. He always put the other first. At his workplace, they have organized a memorial and named a room after him. They want people to remember the great human being that he was. I spoke to his wife today. It's not easy for her, but she's up. She stands for her little sons. She told me that the mobilization of the authorities of the Canadian, no matter where they came from, is a big psychological support for her. She wants to thank each and everyone who manifested compassion, love to the victims through prayers or just through their thoughts. My family prayers are with all the victims and injured who are currently fighting with their injuries and traumatism. What happened is the result of ignorance, judging through the only one angle that other people see Islam, judging through the misrepresentation of this religion. I just want to say to these people, come, get to know us, get to know people. You will see wisdom, love, compassion, and not the things that we as Muslims discover like you on the TV.
That was a cousin of Mohamedou Tano, one of the deceased. She went on to say there at the vigil that we are in a multicultural world. We may have some differences, but we have so much more in common. Let's focus on this to build a better world and a better place to live in. Now, Muslims in Canada are calling for December 29th to be declared a day of remembrance and action on Islamophobia. And Vancouver responded. On behalf of the mayor, Greg Robertson, the acting mayor of Vancouver, Raymond Louis, read out a proclamation at the mosque.
I'm here to read a proclamation, a day of remembrance and action on Islamophobia whereas the city of Vancouver affirms that Islamophobia, like all other forms of racism, hate, xenophobia, and bigotry, has no place in Vancouver. And whereas the city of Vancouver lowered their flag in honor of the lives lost in January 29th, 2017, in the Quebec mosque shooting. And whereas the city of Vancouver hopes that all orders of government will designate January 29th as a day of remembrance and action on Islamophobia for future years. Now, therefore, I, Raymond Louis, on behalf of our mayor, Gregor Robertson, mayor of the city of Vancouver, do hereby proclaim January 29th, 2018 as a day of remembrance and action on Islamophobia in the city of Vancouver.
It's the January 29th, I apologize, and not December 29th, that has been declared as a day of remembrance and action on Islamophobia. That was the acting mayor, and he, in fact, spoke to us exclusively to Democracy Watch at the vigil. The acting mayor read out a proclamation to remember this day and mark this day as a day of remembrance. What does this signify for the Muslim community in Vancouver?
I think this signifies solidarity. I think it signifies that the vast...
So you read out a proclamation in the mosque. So could you give the listeners an idea of what the proclamation was?
Well, the proclamation that was produced by the mayor, Mayor Robertson, and the city of Vancouver was in recognition that Islamophobia and all forms of racism or xenophobia, bigotry, hatred is not something that we would tolerate in the city of Vancouver. It's something that needs to be fought against and pushed back against, that the remembering of the events of what happened last year, a year ago today in Montreal, or sorry, Quebec City, at the Quebec Mosque is unacceptable, and that we would stand with our brothers and sisters and across our nation to ensure that people understand that Islamophobia is not acceptable, that there's this fear that and this hatred and this bigotry is not acceptable, and that we wanted, as a city council, for the people of Vancouver to know this, that the people of Islam to know this, to make sure that we continue to be that open and welcoming city that many people brought their hopes and dreams to when they came to Vancouver here in Canada.
So BC has seen an uptick in attacks against minorities, and Noor Fadhel, who is in the mosque right now, also was allegedly a victim of an Islamophobic attack. Are there any firm initiatives or any firm actions that the government is going to take for making Vancouver a safer city, as you have been saying right now?
Well, that's as you state, it has been on the uptick, and this is why it requires not just government, but us as a society to take united action, to take the necessary steps to inform people to educate themselves, but also to educate others about how important it is for us to have an inclusive society. That through an understanding, we hope that people gain a better respect of their fellow human being, that this will in turn lower the tensions, lower the fears, because most of these fears, I think, are just of the unknown. We, of course, as necessary, take strong action through our police, that we will fully investigate and bring to bear the force of the law as necessary. But our hope is that Vancouver, which has a great reputation as a welcoming city, with the majority of its people being from someplace other than Europe and spoke another language other than English to start with, this is the type of place that I think is an example for the world, and this is why Vancouver continues to, I think, put forward these types of proclamations to ensure that people understand this.
There are some young Muslims in the mosque too and across Vancouver. What would be your message to those young Muslims to grow up in a community where they can retain their Muslim identity and at the same time be proud Canadians?
Well, first and foremost, that it is Canadian to have multiple identities, that you do not need to subscribe to a single type of worship or come from a unique place to be Canadian. Being Canadian is being from many, many places. And I would say to those young people that come that are in the mosque today or from any walk of life, that is the most important thing to remember. Do not be ashamed of who you are and be proud.
Thank you so much for speaking to us. We appreciate your time. That was the acting mayor, Raymond Louis, speaking exclusively to Democracy Watch. But now the demands to mark the day as an action against Islamophobia attracted some controversy. We spoke to Kashif Ahmed from National Council for Canadian Muslims to weigh in on this.
The mayor read out a proclamation to remember this day and mark this day as a day of remembrance. What does this signify for the Muslim community in Vancouver?
I think this signifies solidarity. I think it signifies that the vast majority of Canadians, the vast majority of Vancouverites, stand against this kind of hatred and Islamophobia. No one wants to see anyone victimized like this. And that we also stand up against those voices who are in the minority, who are on the fringe, but who are very loud and who foment division, who foment hate, who spread fear and Islamophobia, that we will not stand for that. And we will challenge those kinds of voices. So it was very important, I think, for Vancouver to have this proclamation, to declare this day as a national or as a day of remembrance and action on Islamophobia.
You said in your speech that there's some confusion about this. What were you referring to?
So there is confusion about what Islamophobia means. And there are those who try to say that the Muslim community is trying to silence legitimate debate and criticism, which is false. Islamophobia, by definition, and is widely known to mean the irrational fear and hatred of Muslims, and by extension, their faith. So there are those voices out there who are spreading confusion and misinformation about Islamophobia. And we're really looking to our elected leaders to show leadership on this issue, to stand with the Muslim community. And I think today we've clearly seen that from both the federal, provincial, and municipal government. And what we've seen today across the country, I think, is the solidarity with the Muslim community. And we hope that we can work with the federal government to eventually declare a national day of remembrance and action on Islamophobia, not just for the Muslim community, but for all communities, that we will never tolerate that kind of hate growing and festering and threatening our communities.
A year since the Quebec mosque attack, Canada's Muslim community is still recovering. Ayman Darbali, the paralyzed survivor of the attack who was shot 7 times as he put himself between the gunman and the worshipper, is waiting to relocate to a wheelchair-accessible home. Over $300,000 have been raised for him, but more is needed. There is also anger surrounding the man who carried out the mass shooting, Alexander Bissonnette. He has been charged with 6 counts of first-degree murder and 6 counts of attempted murder. As he goes into trial this March, some are demanding a stricter judicial process. But there's something more deep-rooted beyond these sentiments of one horrific incident. At the vigil, we spoke to Mary Layton, founder of BC Language Partners, an organization that pairs people to help them learn different languages and build cultural understanding. She says relations between Muslims and other community members in Vancouver should go beyond just tolerance. Here's Mary Layton.
Have any recollections of January 29th of 2017?
Yeah, I remember hearing about the attack and just being in shock. I've lived in the province of Quebec in the past, so I heard from some friends and acquaintances about it there. And I was just, yeah, overwhelmed. And I remember last year that AGL Center downtown hosted an event after January 29th to kind of connect with the larger community in Vancouver and kind of show, ironically, an expression of gratitude for the outpouring of compassion of the non-Muslim community for the Muslim community. And I just thought that was such a beautiful event. So I was really happy to attend that event and invite a lot of friends. And it was a nice bridging opportunity between the Muslim and non-Muslim communities of Vancouver.
So do you think, is there enough awareness about Islamophobia in Vancouver?
I don't know if the awareness level is so high. I admit I found out about this event from a friend of mine, actually, just yesterday. And so I was really grateful to find out about that. And so I was able to come today. But I think, as a lot of the speakers said today, a lot of speakers did a great job of connecting this incident of Islamophobia to all of the forms of racism and intolerance, and the fact that we can be terrible together or we can be good together. Let's choose to be good together.
So you have an interesting story. You've lived in a predominantly Islamic country, Saudi Arabia, and now you're living in a cosmopolitan city like Vancouver. What would be your message to the people who'd want to learn about Islam and change their perceptions, perhaps?
I would say there is something even more fun available to you than tolerance, which is actually connecting with Muslims in this city. I've really benefited from having Muslim friends and neighbors, and you can too. That's like one of the great things about living in a multicultural, multi-faith city. So I think we can go beyond tolerance, I would like to, and actually have fun together and benefit from each other. Yeah, I would say that it's not just neutral, it's like really a positive opportunity. And that's what came to me as I was sitting inside here at the masjid. You know, I feel happy, I feel comfortable, I look around, I see the carpets, I see the familiar photos of Mecca. People are kind, people are curious, no one's trying to convert you. Is
that a perception amongst people?
I think there's lots of myths and concerns. But like I say, I think I've benefited from having connections to Muslim community, and you can too.
That was an original report by Rahmatullah Sheikh, a member of Democracy Watch. We are now going to go straight to another story, which we reported on yesterday. The report was done at City Hall. It was done by myself and a few other News Collective members, Phoebe Chong, Arika Riaz, Olamide Olanyan. And yeah, that was everyone. So the story was edited by Olamide, who put a lot of work into it. I just wanted to give a shout out to him. So we're going to turn right to that. Please enjoy.
There's one point I want to make, which is that an experience that I think all racialized people in the city can relate to. When you walk down the street and you see someone else of color, we tend to nod at each other. Even if it's a complete stranger, even if it's in a completely, you might not even say anything, you might just walk past someone. But it's a common understanding in that moment of the experience that each person has had. It's something very profound in that moment, and it's kind of strange, it's unspoken.
At Vancouver City Hall this Wednesday, people spoke for and against the existing Northeast False Creek Plan, or the NEFC, a plan that could also decide the fate and future of a reimagined Hogan's Alley.
When the city of Vancouver decided to tear down the Georgia and Dunsmuir viaducts in 2015, it created the NEFC to develop the area that would be left behind. The area spans from False Creek to Chinatown. Part of the plan seeks to redress the damage done to Vancouver's black community known as Hogan's Alley, which was displaced when the viaducts were built.
I'm Joshua Tecumseh, or known in the city as Joshua Robertson. I'm communications director at Hogan's Alley Society.
Great, thanks. Can you tell us why you're here today at City Hall?
I'm here to support the Northeast False Creek Plan with certain amendments. The distinction on the amendments is 100% rental housing on the Hogan's Alley block, what's known as the Hogan's Alley block, and 70% below market housing on that development. As well, we want to change the language to a commitment to working with the black population rather than just kind of a vision of doing so. And so we think there's a strong language under that. And we think with that, we're going to achieve some of the things around combating gentrification, things like that. Other things that could potentially happen in this plan if there wasn't a social housing, if there wasn't a commitment to working with the black community. And that's something that we want to make sure that we avoid with any future developments in the city.
There are three options in front of the council. The first is an approval of the plan as is. The second, which is the preferred option by the Hogan's Alley Working Group, is an approval of the plan with changes made to it. The third is for the council floor to refer to staff. This last option means that the existing plan, including the Hogan's Alley block, will be dead.
Several members of the Hogan's Alley Society and the Hogan's Alley Working Group spoke before council. One was Antonia Ogundele. She represented both the Hogan's Alley Working Group and the NEFC Stewardship Group. Democracy Watch caught up with her after her speech.
I was just going to ask, so to clarify, you're in favor of the current plan, but with amendments, or you're in favor
with the amendments that were put forward by the Hogan's Alley Working Group as well?
Perfect.
And any sort of amendments put forward, there are amendments that are being put forward by members of the stewardship group. I've already communicated my support for their amendments.
Increased affordability of the Main Street blocks and a commitment to continue working with the community are amendments that the working group is proposing. Stephanie Allen, a member of Hogan's Alley Working Group, addressed that in her speech to the council.
The Northeast Falls Creek Plan has done a good job of capturing the result of the consultation process with the Black community. Indeed, there is a chapter in a city planning document in this country entitled Reconciliation. That demonstrates that we're moving the needle towards a more inclusive and just city, but we're not at the promised land just yet. That's why I'm encouraging you to adopt the Northeast Falls Creek Plan with the following amendments you've heard today. Changing 15.1.4 from targeting 300 social housing units to targeting 100% rental housing on the Main Street blocks, consisting of 70% below market rental, which would also include the 300 social housing units previously identified. These are City owned lands that you came into to hold the title of because of colonization on Indigenous lands and then through displacement of the Black community. The City should not be seeking to extract funding for the Northeast Falls Creek Plan by privatizing lands into market development.
There were many different groups speaking about the plan. These included stakeholders in the NEFC, such as members from the Dragon Boat and rowing communities. Many people at City Hall discussed solidarity with other marginalized groups who could also be affected by the plan. There were speakers addressing council on behalf of Indigenous folks in the downtown east side and anti-gentrification efforts in Chinatown. Most of them expressed complete support for the plan, but with amendments. Democracy Watch spoke with Listen Chen from the Alliance Against Displacement, an organization that fights against the displacement of low-income communities.
There's some mixed feelings. I wholeheartedly support the Hogan's Alley Working Group's vision, and I think City Council should, as expediently as possible, start to push forward that section of the plan. That being said, that's a very small portion geographically of the entire plan, and everything outside of Hogan's Alley I think will be disastrous for the people who are most affected by the housing crisis. Of the units that that's part of their target for the plan, half of them, in terms of social housing, I mean, half of them are going to be embedded into condo developments as this mass blanket inclusionary zoning of 20% social housing. So there's two problems with that. One is that the city uses the word social housing or affordable housing constantly without actually explaining to whom that's affordable. And so we've seen in the past that a lot of the time when they're talking about social housing, they mean Hills rates. They don't mean welfare and shelter rate. So they're not actually creating social housing for people who are most at risk of homelessness or who are currently homeless. So that's one problem. The second problem is that this narrative of inclusionary zoning presumes that the market will solve our problems, that we just need developers to, as part of their community amenity contributions, include a handful of quote-unquote social housing units. But this is just a market lever that fuels development, that ensures that there'll be 20 to 25 glass condo towers around Falls Creek. So I'm extremely critical of that and of the broader narrative around inclusionary zoning, which we see other cities like New York taking up, and similar critiques coming from grassroots organizations and allied scholars.
Alliance Against Displacement released a statement called the Janus-Faced Plan. It's named after the Roman two-faced god and used as a metaphor for what the Alliance sees as a contradiction in the NEFC plan. One face looks to the past and claims to make reparations for racial injustices. The other looks forward, with only an interest in maximizing profits. The rest of the plan does not help with the ongoing housing crisis or with the issues of displacement and homelessness. According to the group, there might be a fourth option that the council isn't considering yet.
There's precedent for the council taking a section out of a zoning area and pushing it forward and sending the rest back to community consultation. They've done that before. I think if they wanted to, they could absolutely do that.
Could you mention where that?
It was the downtown east side planning, and in 2011 there was a section of Chinatown that had received a whole bunch of community consultation around rezoning, I think around Pender Street. And when the whole plan came to council, they decided to push forward with the section that had received a bunch of community consultation and then to send the rest of it back to the drawing board.
And what happened to the rest of it?
I don't know. Actually, I'd have to look into it. But I learned about that precedent. So I think what will happen is I will say push forward with HOG immediately because people are concerned that the project will completely die if you don't assure them that you can push forward. Don't use that as an excuse to justify the displacement of the rest of the plan and send that back to the drawing board. And then they'll probably turn to me and be like, are you saying you want Hogan's Alley to be destroyed? Because that tends to be how they think. It's within very narrow conceptions of what's possible.
Listen thinks that this plan could be an opportunity to engage with forces causing homelessness and unaffordability in Vancouver.
There's two functions in coming here. One is to try to get City Council to make better decisions, which I think a lot of us have doubts as to what the possibilities are there. But even beyond that, I think it's helpful to take a nuanced look at the plan and outline the broader dynamics. And I think, as I mentioned earlier, this reliance on the market is extremely troublesome. It's bigger than just the cities. We know that NDP's official policy on housing is social mix, which is coded for gentrifying projects. So I think that we can use this opportunity to engage with the broader forces that are creating homelessness in the city and also in BC and in Canada.
After hearing from the speakers, the council refers questions to staff, debate, and discussion on the plan for February 13th. Dr. June Francis, another member of the Hogan's Alley Working Group, talked to Democracy Watch about her hope for the plan.
So considering that, like, you know, a lot of councillors, there's like elections coming up and everything, and like, you know, the mayor is like not seeking re-election and all that stuff, how do you see that potentially? Like, do you see any like choppy waters in the future, maybe like if there's like a new like a bunch of councillors that have different ideas on what this should look like?
That's why we're asking for the support right now. And that's, yes, because if they entrench it in city planning, it becomes harder to dismantle. And so, yes, we think this council voting, and hopefully they have the courage to do it. And I think, yes, sometimes when you're leaving, this is a moment in time where you can be more courageous. So I'm hoping it plays in that direction. Yeah.
Francis thinks that solidarity with other marginalized folks is extremely important to their push for a more just and inclusive plan.
I think it's going to be critical that we find ways to have common ground with our neighbors. I think we have so much in common with the Chinese Canadian community and with the Indigenous community. We've been equally subjected to colonialism, to oppression, to exclusion. And what we must avoid, I think, at all costs is not to get divided and conquered. And so finding ways for us to create commonality and a common mission, I think, is absolutely essential to this going forward in a productive. And I think we really are committed to that because we think it's essential.
To solidarity.
Solidarity.
I'm Alex DeBoer.
And I'm Olamide Olanion, reporting for Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM.
All right, and we're back. I think you just cut off Olamide's name from that piece, but that's all right. So that was produced by mostly Olamide and myself, and reported on by myself, Phoebe, Arika, and Olamide. So hope you guys enjoyed that. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We are now just going to have a brief discussion. Our show normally ends at 6, which is in 1 minute. However, because the show after us, I believe, is a fill-in, we might go over by about 10 minutes. So please enjoy this discussion. I think Arika is going to kick it off.
Yeah, so I just want to start by kind of highlighting the type of rhetoric that was being used at the City Hall meeting. Like everything, like in the proposed plan, everything that City Council put out, it was just very general. You know, there were no specific promises or specific recognition of Black community or Indigenous populations or anyone who was displaced. And, you know, I was just thinking it's all very reminiscent to the kind of rhetoric that's being used at the national level. You know, even looking at Justin Trudeau's remarks last week where he was regarding the Canadian government's official recognition of the International Decade for People of African Descent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this statement, it's completely in line with that kind of classic Canadian apologist rhetoric where, you know, it was more or less an empty statement. It wasn't really followed up with specific promises. And that's kind of, you know, the general rhetoric that Canadian politicians have been using. You know, we're always committing to do better, but it's usually not followed up by, you know, concrete action. And I just thought that was reflected in yesterday's meeting.
Yeah, it's like we are committed to doing better, but that's a vague word. And better than what? What specifically are we doing better than? Yeah, so are you referring to the language that was in the plan itself or like that was being used by the counselors as they were questioning the speakers?
Well, I was referring to the plan itself, like the written official version.
Yeah. And so like what kind of language do you think was missing?
I guess just specific promises. You know, they talked about we're going to make affordable social housing, but you know, no prices were listed, and they didn't even acknowledge all the different communities that would have been and will be affected by this plan.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I know. Like some of the people we spoke with mentioned how they wanted a specific language to be written in that would maintain a relationship of accountability between the Black community and probably others, Chinese Canadians, other people who are displaced, and the city if they continue to own the land and oversee it. So that was interesting to hear. But I think this topic of language and its importance is like really interesting. And I know like that address you're talking about that Justin Trudeau made on Tuesday about Canada acknowledging the decade of for people of African descent. And I know there were some criticisms I read in like an article in Metro News about how he didn't specifically use the term like anti-Black in terms of like systemic racism that has occurred in Canada towards Black Canadians. And like, obviously he didn't say Black Lives Matter. That is probably too radical for him to say. But, you know, missing those direct and specific acknowledgments of racism do matter. And it does kind of make me think of Ramatoula's piece on the vigils for the mass shooting in Quebec, because there are similarities there in missing language from our governments. And I was reading in another article a couple days ago how the Conservative Party, at least at a federal level, specifically will not use the term Islamophobia to describe that attack and other attacks that have been specifically directed at Muslim Canadians, and they instead call it like a hate crime, and they're reluctant to call it Islamophobia because what I was reading was saying that that kind of makes it seem like it's not okay to criticize Islam, which is interesting. I don't know if you have anything to say to that, Ramatoula.
Yeah, that's one of the controversies that you were talking about. So when there was this movement to mark this day as a day of remembrance and action on Islamophobia, some people said, hey, hold on, what exactly are you trying to say? Are you trying to say that we can't really comment on Islam or criticize it? So it's strange. There's this automatic, by default, opposition to anything where Muslims tend to try and reclaim what is essentially theirs. I mean, it's an attack on their faith. So when they go out and try to raise this on a more national scale, there are people who are concerned about a few words being misplaced, whereas what they are actually trying to do is speak against systematic racism almost. Yeah.
You know, sorry, do you want to jump in there, Alex?
Well, I just wanted to add that like this is part of this larger conversation that's happening in Canada in journalism and the literary world about like people feeling censored, right? So it's like, ooh, white Canadians feeling censored, like that appropriation prize thing. And like, you know, I think Jesse Wente of the CBC voiced some really great criticisms of that. But like this argument, like Jonathan Kay and other gate holders in Canadian journalism and literature who are often white are saying, you know, we don't want our freedom to criticize Islam to be cut back on. I don't want my freedom to, you know, explore other cultures in my writing to be cut back on. But it's like, is that really something you're afraid of? What's more dangerous? People perpetuating stereotypes that lead to actual violence, pain and death, or you as like a white person in a place of privilege having maybe some restrictions on what you can write about?
So I see an interesting parallel with the, as you mentioned, the refusal among especially conservative politicians to use the word Islamophobia. I see an interesting parallel with the debate in the States that was happening about, you know, Obama wouldn't say Islamic terrorism. He wouldn't call it radical Islamic terrorism. And the Republicans were saying, why won't you call it what it is? Yada, yada, yada. And I mean, the conservative leader right now, Andrew Scheer, in his acceptance speech, said that radical Islamic terrorism is a threat to all Canadians. So it's just, I find it interesting that they refuse to use the word Islamophobia, but they are just nice and quick to use radical Islamic terrorism and to tar, you know, almost a whole religion with you know, or to conflate the word terrorism with an entire religion.
Yeah, I mean, that's super interesting. That's just like a blatant irony. Like, that's
irony. I would call it hypocrisy.
Hypocrisy, rather. Maybe still ironic, but yeah, it's that's very interesting. Yeah, if you're not going to use the word Islam as tied to hate crimes committed or caused, then don't use it for either.
Touche.
Yeah, so besides that, being at the City Hall on Wednesday, one thing that came up a lot that was discussed in our story was the sort of solidarity and recognition between different groups who were displaced when the viaducts went up in the 60s under the banner of removing urban blight, which was a phrase the city used. And so one thing that we talked about in the piece is this idea that while the city is trying to reconcile with its displacement of the Black community by hopefully building this community center, it's still, through its policies, accepting gentrification and the displacement of different groups of people who are often of marginalized groups. So, like, in the downtown east side, there's a lot of people being displaced by unaffordable housing. And so this process of displacing people and letting the places they live within the city kind of become decrepit and like not putting as much care into them, and then being like, oh, well, we need to improve this area. We need to have like better housing. It's still going on. So it's kind of a weird thing to hear this process happening where they're acknowledging what they did, but not what they're still doing. I don't know. Anyone have anything to say about that? Newsies, Arika?
I mean, yeah, if this plan is not amended, then like you were saying, the legacies of displacement that, you know, Vancouver has been complacent in are just going to continue.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, well, I don't know. It's hard to say what will happen.
So do you think they're going to amend the plan? Do you think it's going to be passed as is? Do you think it's going to be rejected? What kind of sense did you get from the meeting?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think we were all kind of talking about that, speculating. I mean, I think the consensus, and maybe others can comment on this, was that it would look pretty bad if they didn't pass this community center. Like, I think this issue's gotten a lot of press. And while the Black community is small in Vancouver, this issue is like, it has been one that's been in the media for a few years, at least that I've been following. And so I feel like they're going to pass it. And probably they're not, my guess is they're not going to include the amendments to up the amount of social housing. And they probably won't follow through with a commitment to be accountable to the communities that live there. But that's maybe a pessimistic view. I don't know.
I wasn't there at City Hall, obviously, but I think I have hope that they will pass the amendment as is. I can't see City Hall in Vancouver kind of making a move that would affect African Canadians. I think from a Vancouver and a Canadian perspective, that would look obviously really awful. And what we've seen in the United States, I think it's just very un-Canadian of us.
Yeah, or is it very Canadian of us?
Yeah, it's really interesting.
I know, I'm too naive.
Yeah, it's interesting that Aiden's saying that it's in Canadian. If you remember Jesse Brown's podcast, Canada Land, when he's discussing about switching to the story that I was working on the Quebec mosque attack, so he was saying that this doesn't really sound like Canada, a man entering a place of worship and gunning down six people, injuring so many others.
So he initially sets off with the journey saying that this doesn't really sound like Canada. And then he goes on to say that this is actually very uniquely Canadian, because in the whole of North America, there's never been an incident where someone's walked into a place of worship and just gunned people down. So
a mosque specifically.
Absolutely. Yeah. But it's just funny because sometimes it just gives me an impression that there's so much of optics involved in discussing about Canada and its response and its place in the global platform. And it's just that when these events of great magnitude take place, it just really throws people off, whether it is something as small as the state of the African Canadians, or if it is a fatal shooting, right? It just gives you a sense of something that's worth reflecting on.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of myths that we have been taught and that we tell ourselves that perpetuate to this day, and we're only really starting to re-examine, or at least some of us are starting to re-examine those.
Yeah, like younger, it seems more younger generations. And like, I think it, to build off of like comments made on Canada Land, I think it was the last episode, which I also listened to. An interesting point that was made in that discussion was that, and I don't know if this was specifically said or this is what I kind of like picked up on from what they were talking about, but like the men who were shot down, the six men whose names you read out, it's like, I think part of the reason that this massacre is like already being forgotten or not being given as much media attention as other tragedies, especially tragedies that are similar in America, is that these men were not seen as Canadian, right? Like, it seems like they were seen as immigrants who didn't integrate into like our society, and they were part of a religion that is not seen as Canadian. And so there's this othering that's happening, and it's enhancing this collective unremembering. So that's interesting to reflect upon. Definitely some systemic racism there. I don't know if we can wrap this up, if everyone else is good. This has been a special extended version of Democracy Watch. We went over by 12 minutes. So thanks for putting up with us. So this is, as I said, Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We're going to close the show. Thanks for listening. We will be back again next Thursday at 5 p.m. Stay tuned for more CITR.